Very good to be here with you. I think back in Bible study, we're going to be concluding our account of the Gospels this evening, and then we'll get into a survey on the book of Acts. We are looking this evening at the final events of Christ's life, the events that culminated with his crucifixion and his resurrection. This is, of course, ultimately the whole focus of the gospel account, and so much material is spent on it. Take the book of John, for instance, and you find that beginning in John 13, we get to the events of the final Passover, and we go all the way back to John 21. That whole section, virtually, let's say, over a third of John's gospel, is focused on the crucifixion and the resurrection. Here, as he explains as to why he wrote this book, and John emphasizes, and all of the gospel accounts do, that these things are written that we might believe, that we might know and understand that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the Messiah. Luke states it in Acts, which is really the second volume of a two-volume work, Luke and Acts. And he told the man to whom he was writing that here in the book of Luke and in the book of Acts, emphasizing that, you know, he wanted Theophilus to have a clear understanding, as he says, Luke 1, verse 4, that you might know the certainty of those things wherein you have been instructed. That you might know the certainty of those things. John expresses it in the book of John, chapter 20, in verse 30. He says, many other signs did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. Now, these are written, why? That you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. So, these gospel accounts ultimately were written that we might know and understand, be able to identify that Jesus of Nazareth was in reality the Messiah that was promised, that he is in reality the Son of God. And that through faith in him, through trusting him, we might ultimately enter into life. Because to trust him is to follow him. You know, if you and I won't follow him, then we clearly don't trust him. So John emphasizes that. Luke emphasizes that. And all of the gospel writers do in their own way. They don't all come out and maybe state it in quite these, you know, quite that way. But when you read all of them with this perspective in mind, and they lead up to, they culminate in the crucifixion and the resurrection, because that is the focus of the mission of Jesus Christ. One is his crucifixion. The term is used, his vicarious atonement. That just means that in our place, he took our place to pay the penalty for sin. That, of course, is the essence of his crucifixion, that it is by his death that we are reconciled to God. And then that was not the end, because he was raised from the dead and he's alive, and so he is now functioning in an ongoing way as our high priest, our intercessor. And that is the case. And we'll see some reference to that as we go on through it. Let's just notice briefly here in the, let's pick up in the book of John, and we will go from there. I'll pick it up back in John 18 where we left off. And we find, of course, the account of his arrest in the garden recorded in John 18. And it talks about Simon Peter in verse 10 cutting off the ear of the high priest's servant, a man by the name of Malchus. And then as we come on down, we have the account of the Christ's arrest and his trial and the events that are given there. We find as we in verse 24, Annas sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. And Peter, of course, was standing there warming himself, and this is his denial of Jesus. You know, he was on the spot and scared and denied that he knew it. And then we find, of course, the cock crowed. This is what Jesus had said would happen, verse 27. Then verse 28, they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Pilate then went down unto them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? They didn't like being questioned. They said, you know, if he weren't a malefactor, if he weren't a criminal, we wouldn't have delivered him up. Notice here, though, we learn something that clearly the Pharisees and the religious leaders in Jerusalem were eating the Passover differently than Jesus and his disciples. Because as we went through last time, Jesus and his disciples ate the Passover before he was arrested. You know, and Paul emphasizes that back in 1 Corinthians 11 when he said, this I received of the Lord Jesus, that on the same night that he was betrayed, he took bread and broke it. That is in 1 Corinthians 11, 23. The Lord Jesus, the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. When he had given thanks, he broke it, said, take, eat, this is my body broken for you, this do in remembrance of me. After the same manner, he took the cup. So, Christ ate the Passover with his disciples, and that's what it's called in the gospel accounts, prior to his arrest. After his arrest, and they had had this this trial on through the wee hours of the morning, they came to Pilate's judgment hall early in the morning, but notice they wouldn't enter into the judgment hall lest they should be defiled. They might eat the Passover. So they hadn't eaten it yet. They were a day later than Christ. They ate the Passover at the end of the 14th, as the Jewish community does today, and we eat it at the beginning of the 14th, as Jesus and his disciples did, which, you know, in my estimation, you really wouldn't have to go any further in terms of getting into technicalities of the Old Testament and the Hebrew. If you have a choice, Christ did it one way and the Pharisees did it the other way, which one do you think you ought to follow? Whose example? You know, it's sort of like the question on, do you want to be a millionaire, you know, and the clock is ticking and you're sitting there. Now, let's see, Christ or the Pharisees, which one should I follow, you know? Is that your final answer? It's really sort of incredible when you look at it that way, that, you know, in that regard. But we find clear evidence that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious leaders, were, as a group, doing it differently than Jesus did. Now, Jesus said that they valued the traditions of the elders more than the commandments of God. So that ought to tell us that when their practice differed from Jesus, what was it? Was it because they understood the Old Testament better than he did? No, it was because they valued tradition more than Scripture. So I think that is an important thing. I think another thing it shows is a little bit about their mindset and their matter of priorities. Their real concern, I mean, the thing they were the most worried about was being defiled by coming into Pilate's judgment hall. They weren't worried about being defiled for having bribed Judas. They weren't worried about being defiled for plotting murder, for suborning perjury, which they had done. You remember, we read last time how they bribed false witnesses. I mean, none of those things were going to defile them, but coming in where Pilate was, now that was a serious matter. It's that sort of mindset that caused the most scathing rebukes that Jesus ever gave anyone, because their whole set of priorities and what was important was askew. Well, Pilate told them to take him and judge him according to their law, and they didn't want to do that because they weren't allowed to put him to death, and they wanted him dead. And Jesus, of course, had prophesied earlier, and it's recorded in the book of John, what manner of death he would die. So Pilate entered into the judgment hall and called Jesus and began to quiz him. Are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus said, well, you know, is that your question? Is that something that you're wondering about, or you just hear it from other people? Well, Pilate said, am I a Jew? Your own nation, the chief priests have delivered you unto me. What have you done? And Jesus said, okay, you know, I'm a king. My kingdom, though, is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. Now is my kingdom not from hence. This is one of the clear statements, of course, relative to why we don't involve ourselves in military service. Christ said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, then my servants would fight. We don't fight because our kingdom is not a part of this world, this society. Christ, you know, responded to his question about being a king, that you say I am a king. To this end was I born. You know, for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Of course, Pilate, imbued with the philosophy of his day, said, what is truth? You know, how can you really know what truth is? And went out again to the Jews and said, I find no fault in him. Do you have a custom that I should release someone at the Passover? What about if I release him? And they said, no, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. here was, as you go through all of the gospel accounts, Barabbas was involved in murder. He had led a bunch of people in a rebellion. He was out trying to overthrow the government. If Barabbas were alive today, he would be very active in the militia movement. That was sort of his thing. He was sort of in the first century equivalent of that. Undoubtedly, the groups that were trying to overthrow the Romans and were involved in many cases were bandits. They were robbing and doing various things. Now, as you put the rest of the story together, Pilate's role is interesting because, ultimately, Pilate, he was not that different than most politicians today. One thing we know clearly is that Pilate was a pretty shrewd observer. He understood why all of this was going on. We're told in Matthew 27, in verse 18, where we're given the account. This is in Matthew 27:17. Said, who shall I release, Barabbas or Jesus? Verse 18, for he knew that for envy they had delivered him. See, Pilate was shrewd enough. He came to the conclusion that Jesus was an innocent man and that these men had been motivated by envy. He recognized that. You know, the Romans prided themselves on Roman law. That was, in a sense, one of the great things of the Roman Empire. Emphasized the rule of law. Pilate was the Roman governor. Pilate found himself in a situation where he knew he had an innocent man. He knew this whole thing was trumped up. He knew there was jealousy. But Pilate wanted to release Jesus, but as you read the account, you find that when he said, well, look, why don't I just go ahead and turn him loose, that immediately they began to, the religious leaders began to flare up and say, look, if you release this man, you're no friend to Caesar. We're going to tell Caesar. We're going to write a letter, and we're going to complain to Rome. We're going to tell him, you turn this fellow loose who claims to be a king. You know, we have no king but Caesar. Boy, was that ever a reversal of what they had said a little earlier. But, you know, Pilate got scared. That was really the bottom line. When they threatened to complain to Rome, Pilate got scared. Because now his career was on the line. You know, he had worked all his life, his adult life, you know, to work his way up in the Roman government. And he was a governor of the Roman province. Pilate did not want a black mark on his name. And when it looked like that if he stood on principle, he might lose his job because, you know, you never can tell. Complaints be written back to Rome. They liable to jerk him back for some sort of investigation that he obviously wasn't handling things very, very well because there was a big riot. You know, the interesting thing is, a few years later, the very thing that Pilate feared came upon him. Pilate ultimately did return to Rome and did lose his job and was accused of incompetence and mishandling the situation on a later occurrence. I think there's a valuable lesson that, you know, when we try to protect ourselves and we go against what we know is right, it'll always come back on us. You remember we went through earlier in the Gospel of John how the religious leaders justified their actions by saying, if we don't do something, everyone is going to believe on him. And then the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation. They said, we've got to do something, because if we don't, Romans start hearing all this talk about a Messiah and a king. First thing you know, they're going to come in and they are going to clamp the lid on. And they're going to take away our job. They're going to take away our nation. We've got to do something. You see, they justified their sinful actions. Because you have to say that lying and murder... They certainly knew those weren't good things. I mean, these were men. If you'd ask them, do you think the law has gone away? Oh, they would have been incensed. Oh, they believed in the law, placed their confidence in the law. And yet, they wound up in compromise major tenets of the Ten Commandments. Because in their mind, if we don't do something, we're going to lose everything. Pilate knew what the right thing to do was, but he got scared. And he said, you know, I know this fellow's innocent, but it's not worth it. I may lose my job over this. I may get in trouble in Rome and get demoted, lose my governorship. You never can tell. I don't want to stir up trouble. And it's a valuable lesson for us because, you know, we're not in the... most likely we'll never be anywhere near the exact role that Pilate was. But the temptation and the test is something we all encounter at different times in our life. You get in the jam, the pressure is on. Do you seek to protect yourself by going contrary to what God says, by violating the commandments, or not? In other words, are we going to allow our fears to rule us and control us? As we come on through the story, of course, you find that let's look briefly at Luke's account, Luke 23, verse 1. The whole multitude of them arose, led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him. And they said, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is the Messiah, that he's a king. So these were the accusations. Pilate examined him, and in verse 4, Pilate told the chief priests and the people, I find no fault in this man. So after Pilate had examined him, he was convinced that these were false charges. They were the more fierce, saying he stirred up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. So they continued to accuse and accuse. Now, Pilate, of course, was looking for a way off the hook. I mean, he really didn't want to assent to the death of Jesus because he knew it was wrong. And so when he heard the mention of Galilee, he said, is this fellow by any chance a Galilean? And they said, oh, yeah. Well, as soon as he knew that, He said, well, you know, really, I think he probably, Herod, you know, he's king up there in Galilee. He's here in town. I think we probably ought to send him over to Herod. Herod's the fellow that ought to make this decision, you know, for passing the buck. And so he sent him over to Herod. Now, when Herod saw him, he was exceeding glad. Verse 8. Why? He'd been wanting to see him for a long time because he had heard a lot of things, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. Now, you know, it's sort of interesting. Sometimes you think, well, Herod didn't have any religion. Oh, yeah, Herod had religion. His religion, well, you remember back 2 or 3 months ago, it's been at least that long, maybe a little longer, there was an article in the Dallas paper about this preacher here in Dallas that was having these slain in the spirit revivals, and it was big, big article, big color picture in there, because he was claiming that when he would, you know, lay hands on somebody, smack them on the forehead, and they'd be slain in the spirit, that gold dust would come down and sort of materialize on his shoulders. And it showed this picture of him in there, and it had the reporter down there, and had all these pictures, and you know, this was really attracting crowds. Word was getting around, you know. Gold dust was coming down on people, and this was attracting crowds. You know, if Herod were in town, he'd probably be down there sitting on the front row wanting to see a trick. Now, Herod, one thing you know about Herod and religion, Herod didn't like somebody that told him how to live his life. He got sort of ticked off at John the Baptist because John the Baptist told him that it was wrong for him to be living with his brother's wife. Well, Herod didn't like that. It made him mad. In fact, it made Ms. Herod even more mad. And ultimately, John the Baptist wound up being beheaded. So Herod was like a lot of folks today. He liked the as far as religion, he sort of liked the show. You know, he didn't want somebody telling him how to live, telling him that he needed to change. But he liked to see a show. You know, he considered himself a religious fellow. He had heard about Jesus, and he wanted to see some tricks. Well, he didn't see any. Jesus didn't work any miracles there that day. Jesus was not doing magic tricks. He was not pulling rabbits out of hats. That was not what he did. So when Herod didn't see any tricks, and verse 30 of Luke 23, the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused. Oh, they were getting worked up. They were just furious, and they absolutely did not want Jesus to get on. So Herod and his men of war, they just sort of beat him around, mocked him, laid him in a gorgeous robe, set him back again to Pilate. Herod and Pilate got to be good friends that day, because Herod appreciated having sort of gotten in on this. They had been at enmity before. Well, Pilate again emphasized in verse 24 that he says, I've examined him before you, and I found no fault in this man touching the things whereof you accuse him. He's not guilty. And Herod didn't either. I sent you over to him. Herod didn't find something like that. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll just chastise him and release him. Now, that's justice for you. I don't find any fault with him, so I'll just give him a good beating and turn him loose. And they, you know, cried out all at once, away with this man, release Barabbas, who for a certain sedition made in the city and for murder was cast into prison. So Barabbas, he was a nice fella. Pilate was still willing to release Jesus. But they cried, saying, crucify, crucify. And Pilate said the third time, what evil has he done? I don't find any cause of death. And they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he be crucified. And the voices of them and the chief priests prevailed. And that was the, you know, that was the point, that they wanted him, you know, Matthew's account brings out that Pilate finally came out and washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, you know, I'm innocent. You see, I'm innocent. Well, you know, Pilate was the one who gave the official order. You can't wash away your guilt that way by caving into pressure and then saying, well, you know, I don't agree with it, and it's not my fault. That, I think it's you know, not an untypical thing in terms of what you find with politicians. Very few will take a stand for principle if they think it'll cost them their job. Now, there have been a few down through time that have, but they are a rarity. And you have to certainly respect someone who would place principle over personal advantage. Well, the people made a very foolish statement. They said, well, when Pilate was washing his hands, Matthew 27:25, they said, his blood be on us and on our children. You know, you're washing it away, we'll take it. Well, that was not a very smart statement. The time is going to come when they're going to deeply repent of that. It describes that event in the book of Zechariah. When the time will come when they'll look on him whom they pierced, they will find out ultimately who their deliverer is. As you come on down through the story here in Matthew 27, let's notice one other thing at the beginning of Matthew 27. When the chief priests and elders took counsel against Jesus to put him to death, took him to Pilate, then it was that morning, verse 3, evidently after he was delivered to Pilate, that Judas, who had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I've sinned, and I've betrayed innocent blood. And they said, what's that to us? That's your problem. He threw down the money in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. And the chief priests took the silver pieces, and they had to get together and have, you know, sort of stew about this for a while. They said, well, you know, it's not lawful for us to put this back in the treasury. It's the price of blood. So they took counsel, and they bought them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Now, again, you sort of see their priorities. They didn't have a problem using money from the temple to bribe someone to further a murder plot, legalized murder. But they got so concerned about the letter of the law when it came to this money being back in the temple. It was that sort of reasoning that they had. Now, this says that Judas went and hanged himself. Some have felt like there was a contradiction because the book of Acts opens and we're told in Acts chapter 1 that Judas, in verse 18, purchased a field with the reward of iniquity and falling headlong burst asunder in the midst. And this was known as the field of blood, which same thing Matthew said in terms of the name Field of Blood. Well, it's not a contradiction. It's just each of them tells part of the story. The money that Judas was paid is what purchased the field. Matthew tells the details of how he took it back, threw it down. He went out and hanged himself. Evidently, right there in that area, or right there adjacent or in that field. Well, he hanged himself and evidently remained hanging there for a period of perhaps a few days, and that's, of course, you know, what ultimately happened was as his body began to decompose, broke loose from where he was hanging and fell in a very horrible kind of end. But when you put both accounts together, they don't contradict each other. They each tell part of the story. Judas committed suicide, but then by hanging, but his body was there for a period of days and began to decompose. And this Acts gives you the rest of the story. Now, as we look in the account here in Matthew 27, we find that they were going to send him off to lead him away to crucify him, Matthew 27:31. John, of course, tells the all the Gospels mention this, but Matthew and John each provide a couple of details. John brings out that in John 19:17 that Jesus was bearing his cross and went forth to a place called the place of the skull, which in Hebrew is called Golgotha. Matthew brings out that verse of Matthew 27:32, as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and they compelled him to bear the cross. They brought him to Golgotha. Cyrene is an area in North Africa, and this Simon was evidently known later in the New Testament period, because it refers to him as the father of Rufus. So, some of these people were known by name in the New Testament period. We don't have a lot of information about them, but he was evidently there from that area, but was there for the Passover season. And Jesus had already been badly beaten and had a lot of blood loss, been up all night, and then they gave him this horrible beating, and he lost a lot of blood. So they put this heavy stake or cross piece on his shoulders and were going to compel him to carry it up there out of the city, away from the palace and up to the place of crucifixion. He got a little ways along the way. We don't know exactly how far, but a little ways along, and he began to stumble and was unable, I think undoubtedly primarily because of the blood loss and things of that sort. He was in a very weakened condition. A lot of people actually died of this sort of scourging. So when he was unable to carry it all the way, they just grabbed this fellow out of the crowd and made him carry it. And must have been quite an experience. And just he and his family were evidently must have been greatly affected by what they were a part of, because later on you read of his son being part of the New Testament church, and he's mentioned by name in Paul's epistles. You see the story sort of playing out, and this was to what extent any of them, were familiar with Jesus or had heard him earlier, we don't, we don't fully know. But anyway, as you go on, they brought him out there, and they crucified him. We're told they gave him vinegar to drink mingled with gall, and when he tasted and realized what it was, he wouldn't drink. One of the accounts says myrrh. Gall actually is something that refers to the bitter taste. Most likely, myrrh is probably a reference to the actual substance that was mixed in with the vinegar, and gall was a reference to the bitter, vile taste that the thing had, which would have when he realized what it was, he wouldn't take it. Describes here the casting lots to divide his garments among them. He had a woven seamless cloak that they didn't want to rip to shreds, and so they gambled as to which one would win it. And Matthew brings out in verse 37, this is an example of how the Bible interprets itself and details are filled out. Matthew 27:37 says, they set over his head his accusation written, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Now, if you go on over to Mark, you find a little more to the story, that in chapter 15, verse 26, the superscription of his accusation was written, the King of the Jews. So Mark just sort of gives a summary. Luke adds in a little more details by telling us in Luke 23:38, that a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. Now, you wouldn't know that except that you know, just from Matthew and Mark, but Luke says it was actually written in three languages. They wanted everybody to be able to read it. This is the King of the Jews. Well, John adds in a little more detailed, John 19:19. Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. The writing was Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. So you put it all together, you realize Pilate is the one who came up with the inscription. It was written in three languages. It was placed over him, bearing his accusation. And if you put the whole thing together, it must have said, this is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. So each gospel adds in a little bit of detail. And this is an example of how all of the gospels work together. They're all providing a summary. And any time you summarize things, unless you're going to give a second-by-second, minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour account, you can't say everything, can you? So that means every account is a summary. And the summaries don't contradict. It's just that each adds in certain details that the others didn't focus on. Now, we learn from the Gospels that he was crucified with two criminals. There were three of them, and he was crucified along with them. But now the more details are given here in Luke's account. Luke 23:39, one of the malefactors, which were hanged, railed on him, saying, "If you be the Messiah, save yourself and us." The other, answering, rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God? Seeing you're in the same condemnation, you know, we're all going to be dead in a little while. Don't you fear God? You know, we indeed justly," verse 41, "you and I are getting what we have coming. We're getting what we deserve. We receive the due reward of our deeds. This man has done nothing amiss." And then he said unto Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said unto him, "Truly I say unto you, today you shall be with me in paradise." Now, this is a remarkable statement. Most of the English translations, because of a misunderstanding, sort of a preconceived idea about going to heaven, put the comma in and punctuate it in a way that makes it sound like that we're going to go to heaven today. Well, plenty of other scriptures show that that's not the case. But the real emphasis is this thief had made an amazing declaration of faith. I mean, here, just imagine, here you are dying. You're hanged up here along with two other men. And you're dying. And you look at one of them who, to all intents and purposes, just on a physical basis, he looks just as helpless as the rest of them. He's hanging there dying, you're hanging there dying. And you look at him and address him with reverence and respect. "Lord, please remember me when you come into your kingdom." You know, he, in that sense, he evidenced more faith at that moment than all the disciples who were in the aftermath of the crucifixion ready to go fishing because they thought it was all over with. Now, you know, you think about that a little bit. I mean, that's why Jesus looked on him. Here was an attitude of faith and repentance, right? Repentance, because notice, he made no excuses. He didn't say, "You know, I've really gotten a bum rap." He said, "I'm getting what I deserve. I deserve to be here." Boy, you know, how many people can you imagine, you know, in the process of dying like that, say, "You know, I'm really getting what I deserve. I earned this. I deserve this." And that's what he said. He acknowledged, you know, he recognized that, on the other hand, Jesus had done nothing, was absolutely innocent. And then he expressed faith and confidence that Jesus was not simply going to die and that was going to be the end of it. He acknowledged that, you know, "I believe you are the Messiah." You know, you don't know to what extent did this man, maybe was he in some of those crowds? Did he How much of Jesus' preaching and teaching had he heard? How many of the, you know, what all had he seen? I mean, you know, we could speculate. We don't know, but obviously he knew something. He knew enough to be convinced that this really was the Messiah. And Jesus recognized his sincerity, and he said, you know, I can tell you today, while I'm hanging here, while I'm dying, everybody looks and they think, you know, it's all over. But I can guarantee you today, while I'm hanging here, you will be with me in paradise. That's a remarkable statement. Now, this was about the sixth hour. And this is, in other words, about noon, Luke says. And there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. The sun was darkened, the veil of the temple rent in the midst. Now, Matthew brings out that the temple veil was rent when there was a great earthquake. But the sun was dark for this period of from about noon till about 3 p.m. Now, some have tried to figure, this must have been an eclipse. And they try to figure out, what the date was based on the eclipse. Which is sort of foolish, because a little bit of just rudimentary study in astronomy will tell you that you cannot have a solar eclipse at the full moon. You can only have a solar eclipse at the new moon. I mean, just a matter of, what makes the new moon the moon is between the earth and the sun. What makes the full moon is that the moon is on one side of the earth and the sun is on the other. Now, if they're lined up on a straight axis, then you have a lunar eclipse. You can only have a lunar eclipse at the full moon. You can only have a solar eclipse at the new moon. So this was not a solar eclipse. It's surprising to me. I mean, sometimes in the newspaper you'll read some article and somebody will come up with some theory like this, and maybe that was when it was. I think the most logical explanation, it can get pitch black. You don't have to have an eclipse to have it get pitch black. What if you just have, heavy clouds coming in? When it looks like a storm. I've seen it get so black that all the street lights come on because... It's getting black for a storm. I think that's far more the sense of it. Number one, if you had an eclipse, it wouldn't have lasted 3 hours and kept everything totally dark 3 hours. Just undoubtedly was, this heavy, all these clouds began to come in and it just got like pitch black. And something like that is eerie. When it was like a storm was on the verge of happening, you can just feel even the change in the atmosphere. The atmospheric pressure changes, the clouds come in, and it gets dark. And just even in a normal way, that's sort of eerie. Let it get like this in this context, and you can imagine how nervous everybody began to get. It was unusual. It was strange. It was scary. And then at the point of Christ's death, there was just this huge earthquake that just shook and rumbled everything. And several things happened. Let's go back to Matthew's account and notice. In Matthew 27:45, from the sixth hour darkness until the ninth hour, about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which is to say, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And there were some, of course, who didn't fully understand what he said. They thought he was calling for Elijah. And then in verse 50, Christ, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. The earth did quake and the rocks rent. Graves were opened. Many bodies of the saints which slept arose. They came out of the graves after his resurrection, went into the holy city and appeared to many. Now, as you put the whole story together, the graves were opened when this earthquake hit, but these people were not resurrected until after his resurrection. That's what it says. Verse 53, they came out of their graves after his resurrection. Now, who were these people? Well, they weren't Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, if somebody walked into town today and said, you know, hello, my name's Abraham Lincoln and I just got resurrected, nobody would believe them. There'd be no way you could establish your identity. But what if someone walked up to you whose funeral you had attended 3 or 4 weeks ago? You know, that would be a different matter. I think clearly these were individuals who were known and recognized. Their presence was a witness. They weren't just somebody that showed up and said, I'm Abraham or I'm Isaac. Nobody would have believed that. There would have been no way they could have established their identity. Rather, it was undoubtedly people who had died of recent time. These were physical resurrections, like the resurrection of Lazarus. People whose presence just... Can you imagine the consternation that it would have caused? People that had died, that were recognized, and now they're alive. You know, God brought testimony over and over. This, when you put the account here in Matthew together with John's account, you know, Matthew speaks about Christ crying out, you know, yelling out, as it were, with a loud voice in verse 50. When you go back to John's account, you find that one of the soldiers, verse 34, 19, John 19:34, one of the soldiers with a spear really had pierced his side, would be the better, that's the sense of it, that one of the soldiers with a spear had pierced his side, and there came out blood and water. In other words, that was what had ended his life. His blood poured out. You see, John records that they came by to break the legs of the prisoners. That was a way of speeding up their death, because, you know, what happened when you're hanging this way is you have to push yourself up to breathe. If you can't push yourself up, then you gradually asphyxiate. You can't get a breath. And if they broke their legs, they wouldn't be able to push themselves up. That'd be such pain that they wouldn't be able to, you know, they couldn't push themselves up and get a good breath, and so they'd die rather quickly. Well, they didn't break Jesus' legs because he was already dead. That, of course, was a prophecy. You know, going all the way back to Egypt, when God told them to take the lamb and to slaughter it, he told them that they weren't to break any of the bones of the lamb that they slaughtered for the Passover. That anticipated an event, you know, 1400, almost 1,500 years in the future, when the Messiah would be crucified. Now, the reason, of course, that they got in a hurry to have the prisoners die quickly that afternoon was brought out in John 19:31. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath was a high day, they besought Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away. Now, it was the preparation day and for the Sabbath, but which Sabbath? The weekly Sabbath? No. John is the one who adds in the detail that it was for a high day Sabbath. Now, the day after the Passover is on the 14th, and the day after the Passover is the 15th. It is the first day of unleavened bread. It is a high day Sabbath, a holy day. So John brings in that detail, and that's what took place. And then, of course, this event when Jesus had been stabbed and the darkness ended, this great earthquake shook and broke these rocks. It also shattered the veil of the temple. If you read a little bit about it, there was a huge stone lintel that went across the interior of the temple, from which the heavy curtains that divided the holy place from the Holy of Holies hung. And evidently, when it talks about the curtain ripping in two, I think the indication would be that this earthquake probably broke that stone lintel to where it fell. You know, just the whole thing began to collapse. And when it did, well, it ripped this huge curtain. Because when you read a little bit about the curtain, we're not talking about just something sort of like you have hanging on your windows. I mean, this was thick. It was multiple fabrics. It was very heavy. I mean, it was massive. When you look at the size, this is something that reached very high up in the air, because it was the reached to the top there in the temple complex. So this was this was a huge thing, very heavy, but it was ripped as a result of this. And of course, then that exposed the Holy of Holies. That exposed the Holy of Holies to open view. Now it's interesting. There's significance of that, because what did Jesus' death do? It opened up the way to direct access to the Father. We have direct access to the Father through Christ. You know, the Holy of Holies was shut off to everyone except for the high priest going in once a year. And as you come on down here in John 20, we find that in verse 38, of John 19. After this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body. And Pilate gave him leave, and he took the body. And there came also Nicodemus, which first came to Jesus by night. Now, when you put the whole thing together, it becomes apparent that that there were two members of the Sanhedrin here, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. We find Luke tells us in Luke 23:50, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor. He was a good man and a just. The same had not consented to the counsel indeed of them. He was of Arimathea. He waited for the kingdom of God. He went to Pilate, begged the body of Jesus. And as you put the other accounts together, Pilate didn't just take Joseph's word for it. He sent a centurion out there to Golgotha to determine if he was really dead. And when he got word back, got a statement back from the soldier in charge there at the crucifixion that he was dead, then he wrote out an order allowing the body to be released to Joseph. So you had a period of time that occurred there that brings us right up to right before sunset. And so they really didn't have time to properly prepare the body. They did the best they could, but they were in a big hurry. Now, we're told that Joseph was a just man. He was a counselor. He did not consent to Christ's death. So showing that he was a member of the Sanhedrin. We know that Nicodemus also was, because we're told, introduced to him in John chapter 3, Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. He came to Jesus by night, and he said, "We know you're a teacher sent from God." These men had from early on, Joseph was a disciple, but secretly for fear of the Jews. You know, it's interesting, everybody comes to a point of truth. You know, sometimes you can avoid a confrontation. Joseph and Nicodemus had never publicly declared themselves. They had position and prestige and status. They were recognized and respected in the Jewish community. They never openly declared themselves as a disciple, though they were, and they had probably on numerous occasions had private meetings with Jesus and questioned him and talked to him. But there came a moment of truth when the Sanhedrin met and the pressure was on. What were they going to do? Were they going to cave in and go with everybody else? No. You know, when the pressure was on, they stood up and were counted. Now, you read earlier in John's account that the Pharisees had already made the decision that they would put out of the synagogue anyone that confessed that Jesus was the Messiah. The Pharisees pretty well controlled the synagogues, which is where the people met every Sabbath, to study the law. It was the congregations. And they said, "We're going to exclude them. We're going to put them out." So these men came to that moment, that crisis, and they made the right choice. just like Pilate caved in at the last minute and did what he knew he shouldn't do, but he wanted to hold on to his position. Nicodemus and Joseph had to demonstrate they were willing to give up their position. And they refused to consent in the Sanhedrin, and now they openly declared themselves and said, "Release the body to us. We'll take it. We'll bury it." Joseph buried it in his own tomb. So, it's interesting as you just sort of look at the story and think of what these people were going through at the time. And realize that it took faith, because what your eyes saw was someone who appeared to be helpless and was dying and was dead. How could he be the Messiah? You know, you had to look beyond what you could see. It's simple to us. We read the story. We know all of the details. But it really didn't fully register. You know, they're living through it. And so they had to stand up, and they were. Now, the accounts as you go through, of course, this Good Friday, Easter kind of foolishness that the world goes for. If you put the accounts together, we find when Jesus was buried. He was buried right before sunset. Matthew 27, brings that out, that the evening was coming, Matthew 27:57, and Joseph laid it in his own new tomb, verse 60, and departed. And we find, interestingly, that it was the next day, the Sabbath, when the chief, which was the annual Sabbath, that the chief priests and the Pharisees came together to Pilate. And they said, "Sir, we remember that deceiver said while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days I'll rise again.' Command, therefore, that the sepulchre be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal it, and say he's risen from the dead." And Pilate said, "You have a watch. Go your way." They went and made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone and setting a watch. Sort of interesting. Here they were, out there with a group of men, literally sealing up the stone. You know, they had to undoubtedly bring mortar out there and seal the thing up and do all this stuff to make it fast. Here they were out there in the midst of doing work, right there. You know, they were all so quick to condemn Jesus for healing somebody on the Sabbath. But what you find is that when they were up against it, they were willing to violate any commandment to, you know, protect themselves, as it were. Sabbath, murder, lying, you name it. Well, as you come through the account, Mark and Luke bring out are the key to understanding that there were two Sabbaths in that week. Mark 16:1 says, "When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, had bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning, the first day of the week, they came to the sepulchre at the rising of the sun." Now, hold that spot, and let's turn back in Luke's account. And Luke tells us that in Luke 23:54, "That day was the preparation, the Sabbath drew on. The women which came with him from Galilee followed. They beheld the sepulchre and how his body was laid. They returned, prepared spices and ointments, and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment." Well, now Mark says that they bought the sweet spices after the Sabbath was passed. Luke says they prepared the Sabbath, they prepared the spices, and then rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. Well, the simple answer is that there were two Sabbaths that week. The Passover was on a Wednesday. That's when Jesus was crucified. He was buried Wednesday afternoon just prior to sunset. Of course, all the shops, everything in Jerusalem had shut down earlier that afternoon, generally around noon on the days, on the preparation days. Certainly nothing would have been open on the high day, but everything opened back up bright and early on Friday, just like normal. That's when they went and bought the spices, and they spent the day preparing them, grinding them up, mixing them into pastes and powders, and doing all the things they did. They did that. That took them all day. Then they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. In other words, the weekly Sabbath. That's the only way you can put the two together. They watched where he was laid. It was right. The Sabbath was drawing on. But John tells us that Sabbath was a high day. After the high day was passed, they bought and prepared the spices. Then they rested on the weekly Sabbath, according to the commandment. Then, bright and early Sunday morning, first thing, just as the first light began to appear before the sun was up, they left to go out to the tomb. This was their first opportunity. They weren't going out there for an Easter sunrise service. They were going out there to embalm a dead body. And when they got there, of course, he was already gone. And they were told by the angels, he is risen as he said. You see, one other thing is very interesting. You know, the religious leaders had their own hand-picked, chosen eyewitness. They had picked guards, had posted them out there, and Pilate had given them leave to set the whole thing up the way they wanted to. You see, they had the first-hand report of the guards they had set there. And Matthew tells us, in Matthew 28, verse 11, that some of the watch came into the city, showed unto the chief priests all the things that were done. And they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel. They gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, now here's the story we want you to tell. His disciples came by night and stole away the body. If the governor hears it, we'll persuade him and secure you. We'll get you out of trouble. If you bribe someone to tell a lie, there are two people who know it's a lie. The one who paid the bribe and the one who took the bribe. You know, it's interesting. Jesus told the Pharisees, no sign will be given to you except the sign of Jonah. You know, in a very special way, the 3 days and three nights was a special sign to the religious leaders because they were the ones that had eyewitnesses, their guards, out there guarding the tomb, who were able to tell them what they knew. So they had a direct witness, and they just chose not to believe it. So it's interesting, you know, a very severe judgment came upon that area and came upon Jerusalem. But they were not left without a witness on it. The women, of course, came. They found the tomb empty, and they ran back and they told the disciples. It's interesting the things you remember. John remembered certain details because he records in John chapter 20. After Mary Magdalene and the others had gone, they found the tomb empty. They came back. They didn't even think about how they were going to get in until they were on their way, and then they thought, wait a minute, how are we going to get the stone moved? Well, I don't know. Maybe we'll work something out. You know, if you've ever gone through a really traumatic event, you're just partially numb, and you're not thinking of everything, and that's sort of the way they were, and they knew they wanted to show respect and reverence for him and properly embalm the body and everything. But when they got out there, of course, the tomb was open. They came running back and they told the disciples, told Peter. And as we're told in John 20, verse 2, came to Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved. This is the reference to John. This is the way John refers to himself throughout the book of John. And they said, what she said was, they've taken away the Lord out of the sepulcher, and we don't know where they've laid him. So that was, the first thought was not, oh, wonderful, the resurrection has occurred. If somebody's broken into the tomb, they've stolen his body. We don't know what's happened. Peter went forth, and the other disciple, and they came to the sepulcher, verse 4, they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter, and came first to the sepulcher, and he stooped down and he looked in, he saw the linen clothes, but he didn't go in. Then comes Peter following, and he went into the sepulcher, and he saw the linen clothes lying. So John remembered, he's the only one that adds in the detail. He says, Peter and I took off running. I outran him. I got there first. But John got there, he stopped, he looked in, but he didn't actually go in. Peter came huffing and puffing up behind, but when he got there, he went barreling right on in. And that sort of interesting, I think, the details that we remember, as we tell the story. John, verse 8, then went in also the other disciple, which came first to the sepulcher, and he saw and believed. He evidently had hit him what had happened, in a way that really didn't register with Peter at that time. One interesting thing I would call your attention to, this, by the way, is just a very simple couple of verses that disproves the Shroud of Turin. Several things disprove the Shroud of Turin, but here's just a very simple... No, they never bothered to read the account. If you've ever seen a picture of the Shroud of Turin, it's one big cloth, and it's got this imprint from head to foot. Well, notice, there was not one big cloth. They went into the sepulcher, verse 6, and saw the linen clothes lie, the napkin that was about his head not lying with the linen clothes, but wrapped together in a place by itself. So his head and his body were wrapped separately in two different cloths. So that's just, a little detail, but, it's interesting, They saw these linen clothes, and it talks about them being folded, wrapped together in a place by itself. It's sort of interesting. When Christ left, he left things neat. That's just sort of a very minor little point, but I think it's just sort of interesting. He didn't leave it a mess. He left it, wrapped up. They were just sort of laying neatly there. They were empty. They were hollow. He was gone. And as you come on down, we find that Mary Magdalene was... Peter and John went on back home. Mary, verse 11, who had evidently come back to the sepulcher with them, stood without the sepulcher weeping. And she just couldn't fathom what was happening. She was heartbroken, and she evidently would, go back over and sort of look in again. And this time when she looked in, she saw two angels. And they said, "Woman, why do you weep?" And she says, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." And then when she turned back, she saw Jesus. And he said, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she, maybe didn't even look at him directly. She was upset and crying, and she just supposed that this was the gardener. Maybe he had sort of a cloak pulled up or something. And she just said, "Well, look, if you're the one that's taken away the body, please tell me, and I'll get it. I'll take care of it." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." Just the way he addressed her, immediately she turned and she realized who it was. "Rabboni, Master." And she, of course, instinctively reached out to grab him, to embrace him. And Jesus said, "Don't touch me. I'm not yet ascended to my Father. Go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." She came and told the disciples what she had seen, that she had seen the Lord, and that he had spoken these things. Mark adds in the detail that you would surmise it from John, but Mark adds in the detail that when Jesus rose, Mark 16:9, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene. And so that was evidently the first one that he actually appeared to, and then he appeared to others, appeared ultimately to quite a number. But now he had not yet ascended. This was the day of the day of the wave sheaf, and what you find is that you know, later on he allowed the disciples to embrace him. Later on that day, in fact, it describes that as how he had appeared and allowed himself to be touched after that. And we have the account as to how he appeared to different ones. Luke 24 describes the account as appearing to a couple of them, and they didn't really fully understand what was happening. They were talking about what was going on and his disappearance from the tomb. He appeared, went along, talked with them, describes that in Luke 24, and began to expound the scriptures and how this would have to happen to the Messiah. And then they realized who it was, he vanished out of their sight, Luke 24:31, and they were just amazed, and came running back and how he had appeared, and they told that story. That is mentioned in all of the accounts. Well, Jesus, over the next little while, appeared to various, he appeared to the 11 as a group. He appeared to others. Matthew 28:6 tells that when Jesus appeared to the disciples, they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. He wouldn't allow Mary to touch him early that morning, but he did allow himself to be embraced later on that evening. So that's over the course of the next 40 days, he appeared to them on numerous occasions. As you go through and you see their reactions, first and foremost, they were terrified. Luke describes that in Luke 24 as to how that they were terrified. When the first time when he stood in their midst, scared them to death. They'd seen him dead. Now all of a sudden here they are in a room, the door's locked, and he's just standing there right in the midst. So the first thing he did was terrified. Then John tells us, John 20, they rejoiced. It began to hit them. He's alive. They were excited, and then they worshipped him. That was, what Matthew adds in Matthew 28:9. They grabbed him by the feet. They worshipped him. So you can just see how it sort of ran through. They had trouble really understanding and registering what had happened. There was a stunned disbelief. They couldn't imagine him being actually taken and killed. And when it happened, it was like, can you imagine how quickly everything happened from the triumphal entry until his crucifixion? Just a matter of days. It was like they went from the height to the depth and just were in turmoil. Christ appeared to them, and we have this final occasion. One of the interesting in John 21, when it describes the account of one of his meetings with them, the third time, John 21:14, that he showed himself to them after he was risen from the dead. Jesus, as they were sitting there eating, began to quiz Peter, "Do you love me? Do you love me more than these?" And actually, in the Greek, he used the word agape, and Peter responded with philia, which is a little bit different, but we don't get the full play on words in the English, but Christ kept emphasizing, feed my sheep. Then he began to talk to Peter about ultimately his death. He said, in verse 18, John 21:18, when you were young, you girded yourself, you went where you wanted to go. When you're old, you're going to stretch forth your hands and somebody else is going to tie you up and they're going to take you where you don't want to go. Speaking of the martyr's death that Peter would ultimately die. And then he told Peter, verse 19, follow me. And Peter, turning about, verse 20, sees the disciple whom Jesus loved following. You evidently get the idea they were sort of walking down the beach. Peter looks back, sees John, and he said, Lord, Peter said to Jesus, Lord, what shall this man do? I think this is such... I guess the reason I like this account is because it seems to be so descriptive of all of us. You know, we can get so worried about what's going to happen to somebody else. Lord, Christ just got through telling him about how what was going to happen to him and how he was going to die. He looks around, he sees John, he said, well, Lord, what's going to happen to him? You're not going to get off easier than I am, is he? You're not going to let him get off any lighter, are you? And Christ said, if I will that he tarry till I come, what's that to you? Follow you. That's what Christ tells every one of us when we start looking around and sort of being nosy about somebody else. Well, I don't see how come he's getting by with that. He seems like he's having it sort of easy. Christ's statement to every one of us is don't worry about him. He's mine. I'll take care of him. Doesn't concern you. If I will that he tarry till I come, what's that to you? The only thing you have to do is follow you, me. See, that's what Jesus tells every one of us. Follow me. You just put one foot in the other and follow where I lead. You don't have to worry about what somebody else is doing or did I notice them. Then John adds, this shows how rumors get started. They're not a modern phenomena. The word went abroad among the disciples that among the brethren that this disciple should not die. That was the word that got out. And every year that went by, and once all the others had died, and John was in his 70s, and then he was in his 80s, and then he hit 90, people just felt really confirmed on that. Said, he's never going to die. Christ told him he'd never die. Well, that's not what Christ said. He didn't, John adds that in verse 23. I mean, here's John, an old man. He's writing this, and he said, I know there's this rumor going around that I'm not going to die, and that's not what was said. What Jesus said was, not that he shall not die, but if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to you? This is the disciple that testifies to these things. That's when it ends up, that John makes plain. He's referred to himself in the third person all through the book. Now he says, the one that is the disciple whom he loved, the one that leaned on his chest there at the Passover, this is the one that's written the book. But just, I think, sort of interesting. Nothing new under the sun. Matthew 28 and Mark 16 both end up with a version of what we call the Great Commission. So basically, Luke gives it more in the book of Acts. But the emphasis was that the last thing Christ did was tell the disciples. He gave the disciples... told them he would give them power and authority, and he sent them out to preach the gospel to everyone. Go you into all the world. As Mark says, it preach the gospel unto every creature. He commissioned them. He sent them forth. And, of course, the last thing, their last encounter, was they actually watched him ascend into heaven. Acts 1 gives the details of it as Luke opens up with the account of the ascension. They stood there and he ascended up from the Mount of Olives. And he's going to come back to the Mount of Olives. It's a remarkable story as you go through and you realize all of the things that culminated here in these final days. And how Jesus, confirmed the word by signs, how he appeared to them over and over. And it set the stage for launching the New Testament church. And we will pick that up next time in the book of Acts. We'll be concluded this evening. Our next Bible study will be here in the book of Acts.